702.
The Naked Scientist.
Time for The Naked Scientist with Dr. Chris Smith. Doctor, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm really good, actually. And thinking about things that are relevant to all of us. And I was just thinking, 3 years ago, we were still in the grip of pandemics and lockdowns and things. And it's an important week this week because the WHO are convening a meeting in Geneva to talk about something that was spawned during the pandemic, but which has become a bit of a sticking point. And that was how to get everyone talking to each other and cooperating better when there's a pandemic, so that there's vaccine equity, technology equity, data sharing and so on. And Boris Johnson on the 21st of March in 2021 announced that there was this initiative. They were linking up with the WHO to create this pandemic treaty everyone was going to sign up to. Well, like all these giant treaties, a bit like climate change and so on, they're still tinkering with the wording, and there are lots of African countries that are unhappy with some of the wording and they won't sign up. And the UK said, well, we can't have someone telling us when we can have a lockdown or not, so that infringes our sovereignty, so we won't turn up or sign up. And in America, the Biden administration is saying, we can't have an agreement which might involve transmission and transfer of intellectual property to other countries without our say-so, so we won't sign up. So it's all kind of got stuck. So like all these things, great idea, got mired in bureaucracy.
I need to ask you, and thank you for sharing that, Dr. Chris Smith, before we go to the lines, how do you differentiate as a human being? And this is just coming off of arguments that conversation we're having earlier around a voting, which gets very, very emotional, but also many conversations that happen between men and women, where the generalized view will be women are very emotional and men are more logical. How do you, as an individual, how can you tell, or from a scientific perspective, are you able to look at an MRI or a CAT scan or anything to say this person is speaking from an emotional place or they're speaking from a logical place? And is there such a thing as actually separating the two?
Because you definitely
can. We're having
can.
Conversations
yes.
around registering to vote. Some people are saying there's no way you should not be voting. So many people died. You cannot, there's no excuse. And others are like, well, I'm choosing not to vote. I don't want to vote. And it's causing a lot of tension. I just want to know your thoughts on the difference, because sometimes arguments are very emotional and sometimes arguments are just fact-based and logical.
Well, in Australia, they decided they would solve this problem by just making it illegal not to turn up and vote. And so if you don't vote in the elections, you get a fine or worse. And everyone turns up. Turnout's very good, nearly as good as Vladimir Putin's turnout for his elections and Robert Mugabe's turnout for his elections in Zimbabwe when they're happening. So that's one solution, isn't it? You just say, well, we're going to make it the law that everyone has to express their opinion. The problem is all these things, they're nice from far, but far from nice under certain circumstances, aren't they? But you ask, can you tell the difference, emotional versus logical thinking? Well, yes. I mean, they do involve different parts of your brain, and different people do use their brains differently, and sex does bias the equation. In an individual who is working in a highly logical way, there are parts of your brain at the front, your prefrontal cortex, which weighs up how you are going to interact with others and society and how your actions will be received, interpreted and reacted to by the people around you. And it's a way of putting yourself in other people's shoes. And we use that kind of deductive thinking into the future, informed by the past type reasoning when we're making decisions. And some people are very, very good at doing that. Others, you tend to make more emotional decisions. And those emotional decisions involve your brain's limbic system, where you have a structure called the amygdala, which is concerned with whether you're worried about things, anxiety, fear, learned past negative experiences. That part of the brain does that. And hormones influence the way these different regions of the brain talk to each other. The connectivity of the brain differs between men's and women's brains. And you can demonstrate that with a whole range of different psychological tests. And if you look at, say, people who are on the autism spectrum, they tend to manifest more male-type thinking. Even women who have Asperger's or autism-type traits tend to think more like a male brain, which tends to be quite data-driven and less subject to emotion and much less empathic women tend to be more towards the empathetic side of the spectrum. And there's some very good tests, and actually I found them really intriguing to do, because Simon Baron-Cohen, who works on this at the University of Cambridge, he wrote a book.
I was wondering if it was Sacha Baron Cohen's brother by
age. No, they are related, and they are the same family. They are related. They do know each other, but it's not Ali G. This is Simon Baron Cohen, who's a professor of cognitive neuroscience and psychology at the University of Cambridge. Very, very different. But his book, in his book, he argues that autism is an extreme maleness. And there's a whole bunch of tests he presents in this book where they show you just the eye region of a face. So imagine a person who's looking through a letterbox at you, the bit of the face you would see, their eyes, and just a bit around the eyes. They present those as a sort of rectangle on the page, and they put four words, one at each of the corners of the rectangle, and it will be words like fearful, happy, content, angry. And just from the eyes, you have to think, well, which word goes with what I think this person's feeling? And if you do this on men, like me, I scored terribly. Do it on women. My wife did it, got 100%. So women are much better at this than men are. And that's an average. It's not an absolute. So yes, your brain, although our brains structurally have all the same bits and all the same connections, the relative contributions, the connections and the strength of the connections are strongly different between individuals and also different between sexes.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Chris Smith. Let's quickly take, is it Laurel or Laurel from Forbes?
It's Laurel.
Laurel. Laurel. Thank you so much. Hello. Go ahead.
Hi. Chris, I wanted to find out, why do old people not yawn? I have a lot of dealings with people in frail care and lifestyle estates, and they all sit there and fall asleep in their chairs, but I never see anybody yawning.
Ooh. So that's fascinating.
No, I've not come across this.
Maybe you're very entertaining.
Must be. Well, she did say they fall asleep, so maybe they haven't been listening to this program, because no one falls asleep listening to this program. I don't know the answer to this question. I've never checked into it to see whether there is a proven study looking at the yawning frequency by age. Yawning is strongly contagious, and social creatures, when we're around each other, we watch what everyone else is doing and we do what they're doing in sympathy. As we get older, we do get less good at worrying about what other people think, and we are less concerned, and we might have sight problems, we might have other sort of cognitive problems that mean we're less in tune with what other people are doing, therefore we're less likely to copy them. But if it's easy to drop off to sleep rather than yawn and have to stay awake, then, well, you've got no reason to stay awake, just drop off. But it's an interesting question, Lauren. I'm going to look into this and see if anyone's done a yawning frequency by age study, or if anyone indeed who's listening to this program has done such or knows of such, do let us know. But I'll take it away as homework otherwise, and I'll bring you back an answer next week.
There's a question here, Dr. Smith, that says, can my pregnant wife drink Coke Zero? I'm not sure if specifically the brand, and if we need to distinguish between soda in general.
Yes, very important question, because everyone worries about everything they eat and drink when they're pregnant, for obvious reasons, because you're not eating just for yourself. What you take into your body doesn't exclusively all go, but some can go into your developing baby. And some substances can affect the health of a developing baby, the way the tissues develop, the way that the baby's health in general goes. So what's the story here? Well, the one thing that's in a lot of these fizzy beverages that makes you enjoy them is the fact that they've got caffeine in them. And people have looked very hard at this because of the popularity of coffee, and people who drink a lot of coffee then wonder, well, what should I do when I get pregnant? And so there are some studies which have looked at intake of coffee, so by that we can read caffeine, against safety in pregnancy. And so if we say, well, it's all down to the caffeine, then the guidance is, if you drink less than a couple of cups of coffee every day, there's no evidence of any association with an adverse outcome in pregnancy. So, and by a couple of coffees, we don't mean a massive, great mega bucket or something. We're talking about normal coffee intake that an average person would have. About two cups of coffee a day appears to be absolutely fine. So if you assume that a cup of coffee's got about as much caffeine in it as a fizzy drink, then probably a can of fizzy drink, that's going to be okay. But I don't know of any specific clinical trial where anyone has looked at this. I'm sure it has been done. People have done these things. Insurance companies are very, very keen on looking at this kind of thing, particularly in America, because they want to make sure that they understand the risk profile, for example. And then when they quiz you, what do you eat, what do you drink, and they make a profile that they can form as the way of informing their premiums, they use all this information. So people have looked at this and insurance companies have looked at this. I'm not familiar with the data for soda, so we'd have to assume that coffee was equivalent if it's all down to the caffeine, and therefore I would say one fizzy drink a day is probably not going to do you any harm.
But we've got a voice note in the meantime.
Good afternoon, Rilibogile, and your guest, the Naked Scientist. I just want to know, Rilibogile, is there a group of people that are prone to addictions? I was a sexual addict. I'm okay now, but I'm beginning to love food. I think I'm addicted to food now. So I just want to know, really, what's happening?
Thank you so much for that one. And doctor, it's not the first time I hear of people struggling with addiction, in inverted commas, resolving the one. And I say that in inverted commas, only to transfer to something else, because we know that it's a much deeper conversation than it being something that just, oh, one to the other.
A very good friend of mine was one of the most entrenched smokers I knew and was routinely smoking 30 really strong cigarettes a day. And I never thought he'd give up, and he did. And then he said to me, he moaned to me and said, I've swapped the fags for chocolate bars, because he found that every time he fancied a cigarette.
Can I please just clarify for our listeners, because the term fags is a British term.
Cigarettes.
That is short for cigarettes.
Yeah, cigarettes.
So I just need to explain, because in South Africa it has a different meaning.
No, he was not addicted to homosexuals. He was addicted to cigarettes. And he swapped cigarettes for chocolate bars. And he then gained a load of weight and then moaned to me. And he said, well, when I was on the fags, I'm quoting him, when I was on the fags, I was not putting on all this weight. And now I am. So he thinks he has something of an addictive personality and now drinks a little bit too much as well. So I think probably there are people who are susceptible. We know that there are people who do tend to have a higher risk lifestyle. They do tend to crave chemical sort of support for enjoyment or relaxation, and they are less good at saying no. But all of us can resist everything except temptation. We're all temptable. Tasty treats, nice things, buying things that you probably can't afford, but they are quite good, so you think you'll make the exception and you do it. Gambling, we all like a bit of a flutter, but some people do get very seriously hooked. Yes, there do appear to be people who are more susceptible, but what we can't say is, oh, there's a gene for this, or there is an inherent cause for this. This is probably a combination of susceptibility of the individual together with the environment and the presence of the temptation that then becomes the problem. For instance, if you were prone to alcoholism, but you were living in a country where alcohol was banned, it's very unlikely you'd ever get addicted to alcohol, or much less likely you'd get addicted to alcohol, because you wouldn't have access to the thing that you had the potential to become addicted to. So I think it's much more complicated than just, have I got an addictive personality? I think that it all comes down to the individual, the environment that person's in, the opportunity for that person to manifest their susceptibility, and a range of things that make that person more or less able to cope if they do or don't do that thing. Money might enable certain behaviours, for example. And if you do or don't have those things, it might enable you to fulfill the opportunity to become addicted to those things. But it's certainly very real. And people who get addicted to gambling, for example, and we're going to be talking about this on The Naked Scientist quite soon, it's destroys your life, because you are so able to access these things, especially with the online world now, that it's very hard to distance yourself from the thing that you know is bad for you, but you are powerless to resist it.
All right. And I'm thinking there is a South African rapper by the name of Stogie T, or people know him as Doomy from The Volume. And you just affirmed and validated what he said. He said, some people will judge people for being addicts, but you don't know, because you've never been in a position to have enough money to actually test what you might be addicted to. So once you have a money to fill up a bar in your house, once you have money to be buying certain drugs, for example, so you might be sitting there judging people, but not realizing you've never actually been tested. And I think that that was quite well said. Interesting question for next week around turbulence and planes. I want to give Dr. Chris Smith enough time to fully answer this one. So we're back on Monday.